Welcome to the Week in IndyCar on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. This week, my guest is, that's right, the Thrill from West Hill, Paul Tracy. How are you, brother, coming off of a long-awaited return to the cockpit last weekend at Road Atlanta?
I'm doing good. I was pretty satisfied with how the weekend went and came away with an okay result, considering I started at the back. I decided to put tires on because I'd flat spotted mine and in the race, and just decided, you know what, I'll just start at the back and it'll be more passing and doing stuff that I haven't done in a while.
You sent me a couple of in-car clips over the weekend, and each one of them looked like you were having a blast, man. And we also definitely, finally, 100% confirmed the chrome horn still works, brother. bring us into the weekend. You were teaming with fellow former IndyCar driver Rafa Matos. You were driving Doug Peterson's big old monstrous Trans Am car. What was it like, you know, what was it, 30-plus years since you'd been to Road Atlanta? Big crazy car, you know, I don't think you've really driven anything like that before. Harrowing track. What was it like having to jump your mind and body into this big task that you had?
Well, I mean, obviously I was a little nervous at first, and I guess my biggest concern was, you know, when I'd left the sport back in 2011 after Dan had passed, you know, I was kind of left with a sour taste in my mouth. You know, I wasn't driving in good equipment anymore, and I wasn't running well. You know, I was coming away from every race weekend not happy with how things are going, and then
sure,
the accident happened with Dan, and then, you know, a lot of people expressed their opinion on me that I should retire, but I didn't really want to retire, and I didn't want to fully retire. You know, I thought I'd go into something else, and I just kind of stopped altogether. And like I said, I told you before, I was kind of conflicted over it. I still had feelings to drive, but just never put really much effort into it. So obviously with the years that goes by, then that those feelings go away and you start doing other things and other business interests and working with NBC, and that's kind of the itch to drive really isn't there. And then all of a sudden it started again a little bit, but not a lot. And I got the opportunity to drive Doug Peterson's car. They called up and said they'd heard that I was interested in driving and said, come on out and try in our series. So I was like apprehensive at first because I was, you know, a little bit worried. I was a little worried I'd be just old and slow.
No.
And I got there and obviously, you know, was nervous to get in the car. I hadn't been there in a long time. It's a car I've never driven. Track I hadn't driven at in years and years and years. So I had to learn the car, learn the track. But, you know, really working with Rafa made it a lot easier. The cars have a lot of telemetry on them, more so than I thought. I was thinking it was more along the lines of kind of like a NASCAR type deal where you've got very minimal data acquisition. And the Trans Am series, the cars are loaded with all the data that I ever had in an Indy car. So, I was able to get up to speed pretty quickly because I had a good amount of data to look at. And obviously Rafa was quick right out of the box, so I knew the car was good. And our feedback really was pretty much the same. The issues he was having, I was kind of having the same things. My first session in the car, I was all over the place, rusty. I was about a second and a half off in the first practice session. Then the second practice session, I was like 8 or 9 tenths off, but I turned a lap that was within a tenth or two of Rafa, and I didn't get the lap in because it went red. So I knew then that I had the speed, but I didn't have the conditioning yet, because at the end of the lap I was out of breath, you know, and I had to take a lap off and then kind of repeated the lap. But I was like, okay, I got the speed, but my conditioning is not good. So,
well, I mean, you also didn't have, you know, 3 months to prepare for this. I mean, you're
no,
coming in.
No, I had a week and a half. So, you know, so from then I was a little bit worried about the race because I was, you know, I was pushing to the limit and a little bit out of breath at the end of the, at the end of the lap. And then obviously, but the first day in the car, I was kind of like, you know, all tensed up and hanging on and like driving with my elbows up. So that gets you out of breath. So I just needed to relax and drive the car. So the second day, I had a night to sleep on it. Second day was better. Final, you know, final practice, I was right there lap time wise, within a couple tenths. And, you know, qualifying obviously didn't go well. It was a lot of traffic. There's 25 cars, and I had to start, they do their qualifying order on points. So I didn't have any points. So I was 25th car to go out for, you know, we all file out onto the track, and there's everybody spread out all over the whole track, and I'm at the back of the line. So I had traffic on every lap and really didn't put a lap together where I didn't have traffic, and had to outbrake some guys, you know, during the lap, and locked up the tires and damaged the tires. So
you sent me a picture of the of the tire you flat spotted, and I don't know if I have seen an uglier tire in my life. So
yeah, I locked it up pretty good.
You had no choice but to go to a new set and go to the back, but you know, with qualifying going the way it was, you weren't exactly giving up a ton.
Yeah, so I mean, I obviously took the tires and started at the back. I thought that would be a good advantage for the race because, you know, it's these cars, the tires fall off pretty bad after, they said after about 25 laps, you've really got to conserve the tires. So obviously the race started, I started moving up pretty quick, and then all of a sudden something happened with the car, and I just got extremely loose. I was coming forward, and then I just got really wicked loose all of a sudden, and I was had no traction and was really sideways under power and in some of the medium speed corners. And I thought I'd killed the rear tires already. I was like, man, these tires went away really fast. All of a sudden, it was there, and then they were gone. And then after I came in, after the race was over, the guy who team manager told me, no, I said, man, I was so loose. He goes, yeah, your back wing broke. He goes, it was hanging off the car, off the back, all sideways. But he goes, we didn't bother telling you because we didn't want to like upset you and have you like come in. We just kind of let you go. And I'm like, well, that's good to know.
So, thanks, guys.
So I was, the back tires were, I was killing the back tires and then basically hanging on. I picked a couple more guys off and was running 7th, 8th. And the last lap guy, you know, he was steadily catching me at the end of the race. I was hanging on for dear life. The rear tires were gone and I was super loose. And a guy made a move in turn one and passed me clean, and I squared him up and came back by him and passed him going into three clean. And then he gave me the bumper at three and kind of moved me across the track and on top of the curbs, and it came around me through the S's, and I'm like, that's not happening. So I caught back up to him in turn 6-7 and gave him the bumper back about twice as hard as he gave it to me, and waited for him just to turn in and then hit him with the bumper, and it spun him around in a circle, and I finished off the lap, and we ended up in 7th. So I mean the good thing about the weekend is really it brought back all the good emotions of driving a car again.
Exactly.
The nervous butterflies of, am I going to do good? You know, the start of the race, is things going to go right? And then putting in a good lap in practice and doing good race laps and, you know, passing guys and then having a battle with somebody. Even if it was for 7th, it felt like a win to me. So I came away from out of the car with a big grin on my face, and we'll see what happens in the future. There's some dates that work for me that don't conflict. And the team is, you know, we're going to discuss if there's opportunity to drive the car some more.
So let's talk a little bit about the receiving the chrome horn and then using your own chrome horn. Tell me about the instincts there, Paul, because that was really the question, right? Among the couple questions here, not just do you want to get back to racing, but the instincts, right? Is the old, well, hey, man, that doesn't work. No. You're not going to get away with this. I mean, can you appreciate the fact that the PT we know, the hard racer that we know, that guy was just waiting, you know, dormant to get back to who he was? I mean, if anything, you would have been upset if that sensation didn't come back, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's either there or it's gone, and I know now that it's there, that it's still there. So, you know, I don't like to lose to anybody, whether it's first or tenth. So, I'm going to run guys as hard as they run me. If you run me clean, I'll run you clean. If you give me the bumper and shove me out of the way, you better have gotten rid of me, because you're going to get it back.
So, as I mentioned in my Weekend Sports Cars podcast, I think last weekend's Trans Am event probably had more attention on it than any weekend in many, many years. What kind of sense did you get in the paddock, Paul, either from your fellow drivers, from the series ownership, Tony Perella and such? I mean, they also had to have a feeling that, you know, the more we have PT here and Rafa and, you know, bringing some higher profile drivers, not just because they're names, but they can go out and run hard and, you know, really make this enjoyable to watch. Did you get a feeling that folks appreciated that, yeah, we need to keep this going?
Well, I didn't really know much about it until, you know, because I don't really follow sedan racing, you know, and, you know, GT style racing. So, you know, when they asked me to do it, I knew that Tommy had done a little bit of it, and he said, no, a series is good. I mean, the cars are fun to drive. They're full tube frame cars. He goes, they're a little bit on the heavy side, but they're not as heavy as a stock car, but they're a lot of fun to drive. And you know, from in terms of going to the race, you know, it's an SCCA event. There's a lot of club racing going on, a lot of vintage stuff there. Not really much of a crowd there, but, you know, but the level of the teams, like the Doug Peterson's team, he's got a really nice operation. I mean, he's got a nice truck, nice trailer. You know, it's like an IMSA style setup, partition wall in between. Everything's set up nice. The cars are super clean and nice inside. It wasn't. It was better than I expected it to be. So, you know, a lot of the teams, the top running teams, are like that there, and the top 12 guys are all. You know, there's some guys that are in IMSA currently, you know, Mark Miller and Shane Lewis, and these guys are good, solid,
oh, yeah,
you know, IMSA drivers. So, and they've been around a long time. And obviously, Rafa's, you know, he was a quick IndyCar driver, and probably one of the top GT drivers in the country in IMSA up until the last few years. He fell into some personal trouble and kind of lost his ride. So. He's trying to recover from that and get resurrect his career again. So, you know, these guys, there's a handful of guys that are decent drivers in that series. So, I think they've got something good going. It's super affordable. Cars aren't expensive. They're cheap to run. The engines run for a long time, and you know, your operating costs are pretty low. So that makes it affordable, and that's why they got 25 cars in the field.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before we move on to looking at the Phoenix IndyCar weekend ahead, which is also NBCSN's season debut covering IndyCar, let's talk about not just you coming out of this Trans Am weekend, but obviously we've had some folks ask, hey, does PT want to get back and, you know, do another Indy 500, IndyCar in interest, IMSA, you know, outside of Trans Am. Are there any other forms of racing where you're thinking, okay, if I've got a free weekend and there are no conflicts, or hell, maybe between practice sessions with IndyCar, you know, if there's another series there you could maybe jump into, are there other classes, other series that pique your interest?
I mean, obviously not an IndyCar. I'm too old and I'm too big now to fit in an IndyCar, too heavy. So, you know, I'd need to slim down quite a lot. From where I am now to get back to an IndyCar, and obviously I'm too old. I'm 49 years old. I'm turning 50 at the end of the year, so I'm past that stage. But there is, I mean, I think there is some, you know, I'd like to do some IMSA stuff. I'd like to do a couple more 24-hour races before I completely hang up my helmet. One of the interesting things that was talked about on the weekend, and I don't know if this will happen or not happen, but Doug Peterson team, he's got two brand new Ligier LMP3 cars that he has in the shop that he was going to run this year. But currently, Rafa is a platinum license. He's trying to get downgraded to gold.
Yeah.
I'm turning 50, which would put me at silver. So that would allow Doug to run his LMP3 car with a gold silver. So that idea got kicked around real quick, and that would be a lot of fun.
Well, the cool thing about Doug, and I realize this is the week in IndyCar, but, you know, look, man, you're IndyCar, I'm IndyCar, but we also get to talk about some of the other things that we love. Doug Peterson's the type of guy who's been around forever, loves the sport, freely spends the profits from his business, or, you know, spends his own money to do things that he loves in racing. He's been in Pro Mazda. He's done a lot of, you know, touring car and GT-type stuff. A little bit of prototype stuff as well. It's just pretty cool when you have someone like Doug, who might not be that familiar to us, you know, in open wheel, but outside of open wheel, he's just a guy who loves this stuff. And the fact that he's opening the door and, you know, helping or allowing someone like you to drive his own car, it's pretty cool, man. We don't get to hear about this stuff enough, but when it does happen, I think we need to celebrate guys like Doug.
And he's a fairly decent driver for
his
age.
Absolutely.
I haven't met him in person. I haven't even spoken to him on the phone, but I asked Rafa about him because I know that he drives in Trans Am. Rafa says, no, he's pretty good. I mean, he's like the second 1.2 or 1.5 off in qualifying, which is for his age. He's 70 years old. He's a pretty decent driver for his age. So he's one, loves to drive, and two, he runs a really nice professional operation. I mean, his stuff is as nice, his truck, trailer, equipment, his presentation is as nice as an IndyCar team.
Wow. Well, speaking of IndyCar, we're heading to, it's going to take me a while, man, to get used to saying ISM Raceway, just like it, I don't know if it ever really stuck for me calling one of my home tracks Laguna Seca, Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca. Now it's WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca, but all that aside, ISM Raceway, also known as Phoenix International Raceway. Interesting event coming up, my man, with our new bodywork, with IndyCar's stated attempt to try and rubber in a high line. We also have the 25th anniversary of Mario Andretti's final win, which you played a central part in. We'll get to that as well. What comes to mind, Paul, as we shift from St. Petersburg a month ago, basically, to a short oval where we saw some raciness during the open test, but I know there are concerns as to whether that's going to carry over or not. What do you think we might see this weekend?
Well, I mean, I don't really know yet, because there was some guys that were really quick at the test that didn't have a lot of experience. You know, Fittipaldi's grandson was super quick. He's racing there for the first time. Kanaan's teammate was quick.
Yeah, Mateus Lays.
Sebastian Bourdais was quick. And that's the ovals are really have kind of always been Sebastian's Achilles heel, other than Milwaukee is a place where he seems to run well, but it's flat and it's not banked like a fast oval, so it's kind of like two road course corners there. He's done well there, but he seems to kind of struggle at traditional type ovals. So Sebastian coming in now as the points leader and having a good test, I feel that if he has a good run this weekend, I predict that he's going to be a championship contender through the year. You know, and where the Penske guys and Ganassi guys are going to be at this weekend, I don't know, because they weren't particularly super quick at the test, so there could be still an opportunity for some of the smaller teams like Coyne with Vasser and like some of these smaller teams to do well and rack up a win.
I know we also saw at the test that the Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan team and Takuma Sato
in
particular
were very quick.
Yeah, when we and I realize we're talking different tracks, but there was a ton of buzz, preseason buzz, testing that the RLL team was really, really on fire. Got to St. Pete, struggled a while, took him a while to find some pace. Graham obviously rallied in the race, finished second, but we're going to be going in there this weekend where supposed to be roughly 90 degrees each day. It'll cool down a little bit come race time, but it's going to be hotter than it was during the test. It's going to be very warm. I will be definitely keeping an eye out to see whether RLL jumps right back into that place, or if the Penske's and Ganassi's, like you mentioned, that maybe weren't super stellar in the test, have taken the, you know, almost 2 months now to look through that data and trying to find what they need so they can come back stronger than before. Do you think that's possible, though, Paul, with body work and such that is still so new for them?
I don't think it's a surprise that Graham, you know, he again, started last at St. Pete, came all the way through to second. So I would, you know, I talk Graham up a lot, but, I mean, he's probably one of the best race day racers in IndyCar currently.
Oh yeah,
I would put Dixon right there with him. But Graham, I think if you counted the amount of cars over the last couple seasons, who's passed the most guys, I would easily bet that Graham Rahal has passed more cars in the last two or three years than anybody else in the series. So it seems it doesn't matter where Graham qualifies; he always races his way to the front. You never see him going backwards. He's always going forward. So hopefully he can put the whole year together. He struggled last year for about half the season, and then they kind of got it together towards the end of the year. So hopefully, you know, with a good solid start to the year, I think he'll be a championship contender all year.
Let's look at Team Canada, our Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports friends. Hinch, a very strong day at St. Petersburg, finishing fourth. Robert Wickens, unfortunately, the record books will show that he finished 18th, rather unrepresentative for his performance on the day. Could have easily had that race won, as we discussed. The one thing that we saw at St. Petersburg is, wow, at least in street course trim, these SPM Hondas are very, very fast. We couldn't really say that, though, Paul, leaving the February test at Phoenix. They were the one team that honestly looked like they were a bit lost. You think that's another one where Hinch, with his new engineer, Lena Gade, who's learning ovals, Wickens, who's new to ovals, should we go into Phoenix with measured expectations for the team, knowing that there's still a lot of learning that has to go on?
Well, I just heard this in I just finished a teleconference with NBC, and somebody had brought up that this track for Hinch is not a good track for Hinch. He, you know, after his crash at Indy, I guess he came back and tested here and had a crash, and then crashed last year in practice, and then crashed in the race, crashed in the test here this last, you know, this test leading up, crashed in a private session here doing an aero test.
So what you're saying is he's consistent.
I don't know how factual all of this is. I mean, you would know more than me, but this is, Phoenix has not been a good track for him. So hopefully that'll turn around on Saturday night.
Tell me a little bit about Wickens, though.
Wickens is going to be his first oval, so I think the job for him is really just to get through the weekend, get experience, and run as well as he can, and just do the best he can. You know, I wouldn't put him at the top of the list, and I wouldn't have put him at the top of the list at St. Pete to qualify on the pole, lead the most laps, and basically get his first win, and then get taken out with two laps to go. So, you never know. You know, back in '93, when I showed up at Phoenix, nobody would have put me at the top of the list to lap everybody twice. But stranger things have happened.
Are there any other drivers you are looking forward to this weekend? I don't know if I want to talk about wins and kind of big proclamations like that, but you know, maybe an Ed Carpenter, for example. He's making his season debut. We know Ed has demonstrated the ability to master ovals. We just haven't seen that in a little while. Marco Andretti, someone who, you know, can from time to time. Are there any drivers you are looking at going, man, if you're going to show it, this might be a really good weekend to tell us if you're really going to be in the hunt this season?
Well, I mean, I'd like to see it out of Marco. He keeps talking about, you know, I just read an article recently that he said he fully understands what the critics say about him, that he hasn't had a race win in a long time, and he hasn't had good results in a long time. So he needs to make that happen. So, you know, there's a couple guys I think that you got to watch. Obviously, Ed has not been in a car for a long time. I don't know how much testing he's done, but it seems as you go on, the longer and longer you stay out of a car and you're not doing it consistently, it doesn't get any easier to get faster. It gets harder as you get older. So he's probably reaching the point where he's probably going to have question marks of how much longer he drives and keeps continuing to do it. But I guess for me, the big question mark is we've got more rookies in the field than we've ever had, and all of them are fast.
Yeah, yeah.
How they get through the weekend. And the three guys really to watch are Wickens, Fittipaldi, and Kanaan's teammate. Matthias Laist.
Yeah, it's another kid who I think, well, granted, he is performing just like a rookie with 1 year of Indy Lights experience, and he won a couple of races last year, including on an oval, but we're seeing with Lace that the kid is either rocket fast or AJ is heading over to the Dallara trailer looking for some spare parts.
And from what I understand this weekend, having just done our meeting, there is no spare parts
correct.
This weekend in oval configuration. There's each team has one wing. There's really no spare aero parts available right now. So if you have a practice crash, you're going to be scrambling.
So each week we do lots and lots of listener Q&A. As I've said many times, it is frankly my favorite part of the show. And we have another little thing that we do here. This is all courtesy of Toronto Motorsports, another part of the Thrill from West Hill family. I believe they were a big part of helping you with a lot of promotional items back in the day. So the one thing we do before we kick off new round of Q&A is I pick my favorite question from the previous week, and then through our friends at Toronto Motorsports, we send them either a Marshall Pruitt Podcast t-shirt with my cartoon on the back and the logo on the front, or a mug. And since I believe most of the shirts are larges, I don't know if we have any mediums, but larges and above kind of point you in one or two directions of what you're going to get. And so my choice this time, Paul, is Curtis Cleveland, who asked the awesome question to Gabby Chavez of, do you hate Alexander Rossi? And that led to a lot of fun back and forth. So, Curtis, send me a little DM here with your preference of a t-shirt, if you are a large or above, or a mug. And Toronto Motorsports, good old Derek Koska, will get you sorted and something in the mail. But you got to respond in order to do that. And we'll kick off the first one with JD Ellis, who says, with the benefit of hindsight, is there anything you would have done differently in the Penske years?
I mean, I don't know.
That's not a loaded question at all.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I wouldn't have badmouthed Roger's car in the end. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, my racing career went the way it went, and everything went the way it went. And I don't know if I would have changed much. I mean, my life is where it's at now, and I'm happy with how it is. So if you do things in a different way, it will change everything else down the line. So I guess no.
Yeah, I guess if you were a 49-year-old driver coach looking after kids trying to make the SCCA runoffs, you'd be a little bit upset. But, you know, things have actually turned out quite well.
Yeah.
Got another one here, and I think this actually has the most likes so far. Juan Bello asks, do you hold any animosity towards Forsythe for not releasing you from your contract during the merger of Champ Car and IndyCar? And were there opportunities you either missed out on before Edmonton because of this? Or was there a different story to what went down?
No, I mean, I don't hold any animosity to Jerry. I actually can sympathize with his situation that he was in. I wanted to finish my career out. You know, my plan really with Jerry is I'd signed a 3-year contract with him right before the season had started in 07, So I had 2 more years on my contract, and I was basically going to retire after that.
Mm.
And I actually wanted to finish my career with Foresight, and then I was going to kind of be done. And I can actually sympathize with him because he was dumping so much money into Champ Car, and he just needed a partner that was going to stick with him and have a partner in it. Kevin had backed away from wanting to go 50-50 with him, and it all kind of fell apart. So, my goal was really I wanted to stay with Foresight. So, was I disappointed with how it ended? Was I disappointed that I had to get in a legal battle to get what money I was he had owed me at the time? Yeah, sure. But at the end of the day, I could sympathize with where he was at with his position, and he stuck by his position. He didn't go into the IRL and start another team. He said, "I don't want to do that." He said, "I want to keep Champ Car going, but I need a partner to do it." And when that didn't happen, he was finished.
So we have the next question from Steven Killsdonk for me. It says, Marshall, how do you feel about NBC using Taylor Swift music on their IndyCar ads? Or as an adult male, were you oblivious to them being songs of hers? Steven, I have to admit, I think my brain just filters that stuff out. And I don't have anything against Taylor Swift personally. I mean, I don't know her. I just kind of find it funny that, when you have music from a young person who maybe has no attachment, or I wouldn't think would have any music that fit anything we did in a relatively aggression-filled sport like ours. A little bit strange, but I think that one just, my brain detuned that one instantly. But are you a big Taylor Swift fan by any chance there, Paul Tracy?
I don't mind her music, but there's I don't think people realize that there's a tie-in to IndyCar. The Borchetta brothers, which were a sponsor of Ganassi,
they're
a personal sponsor of Kanaan and Joseph Newgarden.
Big Machine.
Big Machine Records is they're both big fans of IndyCar, and they love IndyCar, and they personally sponsor some drivers that were involved with Chip Ganassi. They discovered Taylor Swift and own the rights to her music, so that's probably where the tie-in is, to use her trademark music. So there's a tie-in there.
PT, bring in the knowledge. I love this. This is already getting to be super awesome here. Let's see. Let's scroll through a couple others here towards the top. Here we go. Ed Joris asks, if there was to be a reality TV series about your current life, Paul, what would the title be, and do you think anyone would watch? I know plenty of people would watch, but what kind of title do you think we'd be looking at, man?
Oh, I don't know. I guess the title would be Never Enough, because never, finishing first is the ultimate goal for me, and like finishing second doesn't really count. But I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. People have asked me already, do I want to write a book? I've got a couple people asking me when I want to start writing a book or a memoir, and I didn't think I was at that stage yet, so I've got to decide on that here in the next couple of years.
That's a good point. I think the timing might be right, because you're just getting to that point in your new broadcast career where you have the reach and people are thoroughly engaged, but you also don't want to go so far to where folks almost, I don't want to say forget, but, and I'm not saying this in a similar book writing capacity, but I've been in my new writing, reporting, whatever role for, I think, 11 years now, 12 years now. And it's to the point where most people have no idea that I've done anything other than writing and reporting. I have no idea that there was 20 years before that.
I don't know when I'll do it, but I don't want to obviously wait too long to be like, now I'm writing a book and I'm 75 years old and nobody young is even interested in it. I still have a lot of young fans, young go-kart fans, that are kids that are 10, 11, 12, 13. I was just up in Canada a week ago and doing a go-kart event, and all these kids came out to race. So I still have a lot of young fans. And I think once you're not racing for so long, you don't really appeal to the younger audience anymore. That would read it. That would get a book, you know.
That's my whole point. Don't wait so long that people think, why is that TV guy writing a book? You want them to realize that, no, there was actually a really dynamic career that took place before that, too. So let's, Daniel Kincaid. I love this one. It says, Paul, in all your years of racing, what's the best pass you've pulled off? Whether it was go-karts as a kid or even something last weekend, what's the one pass that stands out above all where you still get a smile when you think about it?
I don't really have that good of a memory to pick out one individual pass, but this last weekend was a pretty good one with this Trans Am car, I have to say, because it started out clean, and he passed me, I passed him, and then he hit me, and then I hit him. So it was all on camera, so it was proof of it. So I mean, I could tell a big story about some big crazy pass that I made, and I made a zillion passes, and not really one of them sticks out. But I have to admit, I have watched that little clip that I sent you about a half a dozen times, and I get a chuckle every time I watch it.
No, I got to admit, that was six corners worth of driving. That was everything you could ask for. It was truly perfection in the fun that you can have while battling with someone.
And you saw the video. The guy in front, we were hanging on, like he was sideways and I was sideways, and it was a serious battle.
Raggedness is always a great ingredient. Let's see. Nico Andre says, "Hi, Paul. How's your relationship with Sebastian Bourdais now? And do you guys speak about the good old days at all over beers?"
Well, I mean, we don't have any beers, but obviously Sebastian and I get along really well. I always make it a point to go and see him every weekend and see how the weekend's going. And obviously now that he's driving with Jimmy, and I'll probably be there more often. But, you know, it was really, really good to see him come back as fast as he did, and also be as strong as he was when he got back in the car. He was right back up to speed and had pace. So that definitely a big accident like that didn't deter him from wanting to get back in the car.
I think anybody who wasn't sure how tough your average Frenchman is, Seb definitely showed us the high water mark of, you know, if you're a racer, you're a racer. Doesn't matter where you're from. If that's the thing you live for, you will fight through your whatever personal hell you have to go through to get back and continue to compete. James Doyle would love you to retell the story about, believe it was Elkhart Lake in 2000, when your car stalled on the opening lap, and you're about a half a lap behind the leaders, and then had to drive the wheels off the thing to finish first. He recalls that as one of the greatest drives in IndyCar history. How do you recall that day, Paul? Because the whole back-to-front thing seems to be an emerging theme here today.
You know what? I never even asked about what position I was in. The car stalled out coming up the hill at Elkhart. It went dead on me, the motor. They told me, came on the radio and said, okay, do this, do that, cycle the ignition, reboot everything, and it bump-started, you know, going from turn one to turn two. But by then, I was 30 seconds behind the car that was dead last in the field. And I'm like, oh, well, here we go. And I'm just settled in and just started running and turning laps. And that race went green to checker with no yellows. And I came across the line at the end of the race, and I didn't even know. They told me on the last lap, I said, well, What's our position? I never even asked throughout the whole race. I thought I was going to finish 10th or 11th. They came on the radio and said, "Oh no, you won. You're in the lead, you know." And oh, by the way, save fuel. You're out of fuel with half a lap to go. They said save fuel. So I basically coasted the last half a lap and then ran out of fuel in turn two and coasted all the way down to turn five. So I never asked what position I was in. I just basically was like, well, we're screwed now. I'm just going to run this race and just run the best I can and just turn laps, and ended up winning it.
Wow. I love the oh, by the way, we won. That that's awesome. Nathan DeRover. This is one of my favorite "Who the hell are you?" questions. That's from the first series that I did. There has to be asked to PT. What's the dumbest thing you've purchased? And Nathan says you probably have some fun stories there.
The dumbest thing I've ever purchased. I bought this rat rod car off this guy, and it was super cool to look at. But when you say rat rod, it was a big pile of junk that was scabbed together. And I mean, it was super cool to look at it sitting there on the ground. But I drove it a few times. And one time I was on the highway in Las Vegas, and I was cruising down the highway at like 50 miles an hour, 55, and it was a 1929 Ford Model A.
Ooh.
And I don't think 1929 Ford Model A's went 55 miles an hour down the highway back then. So this thing got in like a death shake in the front end. You know, the speed wobble, the front wheel started shaking violently back and forth, and I like skittered across like three lanes on the freeway, and I was going towards the wall on the inside on the freeway, and I finally got it slowed down to where the front end stopped shaking and I could get it to a stop, and I was like, I drove it back home and put it up for sale after that.
When you're doing 55 in a streetcar and it's scaring you more than almost, you know, any Indy car you've had to crash in the past, that's maybe a little bit circumspect build quality there.
Yeah.
Let's see. Kevin Kerner. All right, this will be a fun one to find out. It says, Paul, I heard a story that in the late 90s, maybe even the early 2000s, with Team Cool Green, you're practicing at one of the big super speedways, either Michigan or Fontana, and supposedly you caught a perfect draft that rocketed your car past 250 miles an hour, almost flirting with 260. Is that story true? And what was the sensation of driving those monstrously powerful kart Indy cars at those insane speeds?
Well, that story is true. I have the fastest trap speed ever recorded in IndyCar, and it was in I believe it was in practice at Michigan with the Hanford wing.
Yep.
And I got this big monster tow. There was a whole bunch of cars lined up in front of me, and we were running speeds at, you know, 230. 231 already around there, and you know, we were running the car with like 3-4 top gears. I was running like a fourth, fifth, sixth top gear combination, and I came off the corner and I was already up at speed, and just I started rolling through the gears and caught this huge toe from like 4 or 5 cars in front of me, and I have the highest recorded trap speed at, I think it's 257 or 256.9 at Michigan.
And you add to that what you had in 1994 at Indianapolis with the 209 cubic inch Ilmor behind you, and that thing being able to sail above 250, and good Lord, man. I realize that, you know, super speedway, you're not exactly feeling the speed sensation like you would, you know, pounding through some corner at Road America or elsewise, but that's still, it's a ridiculous speed to consider.
Yeah, you know, it was. I mean, when something went wrong, then you knew, now I'm in trouble, you know, at those speeds.
Chuck Knobb asks another delightful question. If you were the CEO of IndyCar, what would your 10-year plan be for the sport?
My 10-year plan would be to promote, and I think that...
Fire Townsend first, though, right? Like, we'd get rid of that guy immediately.
Yeah, I would hire Tommy Kendall as my vice president.
Ooh.
And I would promote the hell out of the series and do a better job engaging more with the fans.
I mean, look, if the VP is showing up in the chicken mobile, you're already bringing in a pretty good audience right there. So. Yeah. I am loving that acquisition. Let's see. Now, this is an interesting one, and it isn't 100% for you, but we'll dive into it. Randy Risto asks, how does Oriel Servia get the ride with Scuderia Corsa and not Townie Bell? Both are very good drivers, but T. Bell is already part of the team. Weird, eh? Well, Randy, it is. It would look weird on the surface knowing that Towney drives for the team in the IMSA Championship. But keep in mind that as of a couple years ago, Mr. Bell has an agreement with Mrs. Bell that unless it's a Roger Penske or Chip Ganassi calling, his Indy 500 days behind the wheel are more or less over. So that's why someone like Townsend will be in the booth working with PT and others instead of in a car for the month of May. And Oriel will be in the seat. But also keep in mind there's another angle there, in that part of the Scuderia Corsa leadership is Stefan Johansson, who is a very close friend of Oriel and had been working throughout the offseason to try and find him a seat. And lo and behold, ended up pulling together this really cool thing with Scuderia Corsa to make their IndyCar debut with the Indy 500 in partnership with Ray Hall, Edelman, Lanigan, and our boy Oriel in the car. So
I don't know how much how all of that got put together, but I'd also be willing to make a wager in Vegas that somehow Townsend made money on this deal.
Oh, absolutely. Plus he's got free food from Oriole's restaurant for life, I'm sure. So
yeah,
there's you know he got paid on the back end somehow. Let's see. In all your years of kart and IndyCar, Paul, which drivers were the most fun to be around on and off the track? That comes from Matthew Pope.
I mean, a lot of drivers are fun. They're all of them, like back in those days, everybody had big personalities. But I guess the guy that I hung around with the most, because we were pretty close and we raced each other for a long time, all the way up from through our whole careers, I hung around with Jimmy probably a lot more than anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, the two of you, the timing of your Formula Ford racing to Atlantics and making your IndyCar debuts and such, I mean, you guys were kind of, usually on the same year kind of thing or very close. Or, I know you spent more time in Indy Lights than he did. He really didn't. I think he might have done one race or two. But, the two of you were on a pretty consistent arc the entire time there. Let's see. Let's get through a couple more here, Paul, as we start to head towards the finish line. Interesting. Ed Berg says, I think I have the most obvious question of all. Why race again? He says, some racers, like Dario, for example, once he was done, he lost the fire for it. Why hasn't Paul? Well, I'll throw in quickly, Ed, that if Dario was medically cleared and wasn't risking, potential life-ending scenarios if he had another crash due to all the concussions and brain injuries he's had, he would be in a car right now. It probably wouldn't be IndyCar. He had plans to move into LMP1 with Porsche, and he'd be doing top-tier prototypes, but fire is one thing Dario has never lost, and he does his best to sneak out and do vintage racing. But it is an interesting question, though, right, Paul? I mean, what we look at Mario Andretti, and if you put his name on an entry for this weekend at Phoenix, he'd climb in, right? Do you think there's a reason some drivers lose fire and others like yourself don't?
I don't know. I mean, I that was my biggest worry was when I went back this weekend, is would I still have that competitive drive? Would I still have the speed in me and the reflexes and the timing to do a quick lap? Because that's ultimately what satisfies me the most when I'm driving a car is putting a whole lap together and putting in a quick time, and then obviously having a good race and getting a good result. But I just when I stopped racing, I wasn't sure, I really wasn't sure if I wanted to stop, but I got a lot of pressure from a lot of people to stop, and that competitive fire was there for a few years, and it was I'd raced my whole life from when I was 5 years old till I was 44 years old, and that's all I lived and breathed was racing. And then all of a sudden it stopped, and I had a hard time adjusting to that because the fire was still there, and it kind of got dim and kind of went out, but it was always kind of smoldering there. So I don't know where I'm going to go do from now, but if this race, this Trans Am, was the last race I did, then I'm happy with, hey, I came back after after 7 years, and I, you know, I had a good time, and I felt I could still drive the car at a competitive level.
Amen. All right, you know, I like this question. This is from Graham Wilson. He says, Paul became known as a driver who wasn't afraid to use the chrome horn. He said, nowadays, that would almost certainly draw a penalty. Graham asks, what do you think about the loss of that element of racing in IndyCar? And mentions, you know, the Rossi and Wickens event, that hip check there. Do you like the fact that racing has become more sanitized from a bumping and barging standpoint, or is that something you wish race directors would maybe look away when those things happen, to just let guys police themselves?
Well, Dorsey Schrader was the chief steward now for SCCA for this Trans Am event.
Yeah,
he told me, hey, you know, you can beat all you want door to door, I'm cool with that, but nose to tail, I'm going to frown upon unless something happens that initiated that. So, I mean, I got away with giving the guy the chrome horn, basically because three corners before that, he did it to me and roughed me up and moved me across the track. So that's that. Then it turns into a racing deal. So, but I think everybody is. I mean, I'm not in the chief steward's office, but I think IndyCar allows guys to race each other hard, and I don't think they mind guys banging wheel to wheel and side to side, as long as they, you know, it's not malicious and it's not intentional. And I think the Rossi Wickens thing was a classic case of that. Rossi was going for that gap. Wickens, you know, squeezed in and turned in, left the door open, but turned in on him, and they made contact, and obviously Wickens spun and Rossi lost a couple positions. So that's racing.
That is racing, and it sucks, and I hated it that it happened for Wickens, but as we discussed, it wasn't as if there was 0% blame to be shared on either side. I think the vast majority goes to and will go to Rossi in perpetuity, but you know, as you mentioned, you leave a hole like that, two laps from the end, going for the win. Rossi would have been screamed at, and justifiably so, if he didn't try to make that pass happen. So, as for penalty and whatnot, we could see that IndyCar judge that there wasn't something necessary there. Yeah, all right, interesting one. Looking forward a little bit here, Paul, as we get to the last couple of questions. Anthony Pienta asks, assuming you'll be in the booth calling the Indy 500 on NBC next year, what do you hope the new broadcast contract and single contract, that is, what do you think they might do differently? What do you hope they might do differently? And what do you look forward to contributing to IndyCar's home at NBC?
I know that IndyCar and NBC together as partners have big plans, not only for this year, but also for next year as it goes to one network, and we're going on the big network again finally. We're going to have much bigger audiences, so the future is here right now for IndyCar to finally make a big growth in terms of its popularity and television numbers on TV.
Adam Klinger says, PT, you competed against some great drivers. Who is the fiercest competitor you drove against?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, how do you say who's fiercer between Al Jr.,
Milka Duno? That's you.
Yeah,
I mean, come on, man.
I'd say who's fiercer between Al Jr., Michael Andretti, Alex Zanardi, Juan Pablo Montoya, Dario Franchitti. the list goes on and on. I mean, I could keep going all day. So or Sebastian Bourdais? How do you say who's a tougher driver to beat? They're all amazing.
I think the answer is you have to think about what answer would piss off the most of those, you know, like the most of them. You'd have to pick someone where all of them felt really slighted. But, you know,
yeah.
That's okay. Let's see. Nicole Bitzer asks, PT, if you haven't already, would you go off-road racing?
You know what? I've actually talked about it. I'd like to do the Baja 1000. I went to the Mid 400 a couple weeks ago, and a friend of mine was doing it, and had a good time there and started talking to some guys. So there's a couple little bucket list things that, in off-road I'd like to do.
All right, Ben Cohen, I'm suggesting, I'm not saying for sure, this might end up being my favorite question of the week. PT, Molson or Labatt's to celebrate a win?
For me, it would be Molson Canadian.
Good man. Good man. You know, let's close here. Last question or two, but I want to save the last one talking about the 93 race. Let's go here with... All right, there we go. You and I have spoken about this before, but I don't know if fans have heard about it enough. Maybe we'll do a separate, a dedicated podcast on this, a short-form one, but at least for now to close out. Kevin Kemp says, Paul, can you tell us about your Formula One test with Benetton, and how close are you to being a Formula One driver?
Well, I mean, I don't know how close I was. I went over there and was invited by Bernie Ecclestone to do a test with Benetton, and I went... And then the test kind of got derailed on the first day because Flavio wanted me to sign a personal services contract with him, and things got a little bit sideways, and then Bernie had to get involved, and I finally got in the car, and then ultimately I did pretty well in the test, and then a contract was offered to me by Flavio, and it was contingent upon this personal services arrangement with him, and it just really didn't make a lot of sense at the time. At that time, I was doing really well in Indy cars and winning races, and I had an opportunity to, I had a contract on the table with Newman Haas to drive for them, and I thought, you know what, I can go to Newman Haas and be sponsored by Budweiser and Kmart, and it's a big time deal, and they're going to pay me a lot of money, and I'll win races, maybe win, hopefully win a championship, and then the F1 thing will come around again, and it just never did again.
Yeah, we definitely need to go a little bit. We'll find some time to do a separate short form podcast on that test, because although you and I have spoken about it a couple times, it's still a fascinating story to present to folks. Let's see. Darren Wicken asks a question here, which would be interesting to find out a little bit of the behind the scenes stuff. He says, I love the way that Paul speaks his mind without filter in your commentary. He said he almost did a real-life spit take when you made the Marco Andretti Uber comments a little while ago. He said, was there any fallout from that? And maybe more along the lines of, we know that, you know, whether it's a Sam Flood, Rich O'Connor, Terry Ligner, there's a lot of good folks who love IndyCar and want you in particular to be you. But do you get any, I don't know, pushback or any reins being tightened saying, all right, man, come on, tone it down? Or how does that, how does stuff like that go down?
No, they've only just told me that I need to not swear on air. And I've also been told they don't like my my political posts on social media. So I've had to tone that down a little bit, too.
Yeah, I've had a couple folks ask me to ask you about a variety of political posts. And as I mentioned to one friend who wanted me to take you to task for something, if we drew battle lines between political leanings, religious leanings, you name it, none of us would talk to one another in the paddock, because everybody has so different views on, you know, like really passionate views in different areas, that racing is the one thing that unifies us. So let's not unwind that. So we're just going to stick to the sport that we love here. All right, this will be the last question, and before we get into a close on Phoenix 1993, Dan Glass asks, what is Paul's views on bumping this year? He says, given the practical difficulties, trackside, you know, tradition aside, do you support bumping, whether it's one car or five cars, or do you fall in the, if they show up, let them run?
No, I'm good with it. If there's 36 cars, then that's great. I mean, the guys got to actually run for time to get in and not just, you know, just go out and turn four laps and put it in at 10 miles an hour off the pace. I'm all for it.
So let's close, PT, about this celebration we have coming up. Mario Andretti being celebrated for his final win. We have a number of the drivers, a number of the cars from the 93 race there. The folks at ISM Raceway, a.k.a. Phoenix, Mr. Sperber, who's ahead of the track. It was a great idea that he came up with to kind of have this modern race, but also celebrating this 25-year anniversary. What comes to mind, man? I know you're going there to do a job, but there's also this anniversary where you go, well, if it weren't for you, we wouldn't be celebrating Mario's last win there.
I guess I could say that I handed Mario his last win of his career. And I don't know how much a lot of that will get played up at this celebration they're having. I know they're having some type of a reception party type thing on Wednesday or Thursday before the race, and they're going to be showing the race. And I don't know if they'll skim over the fact that I had I was two laps ahead of them with 20, 25 laps to go and threw it away. But, hey, it was Mario's last win, and it was just another piece of the puzzle of my career. And I can say I went on to the next week was Long Beach, and I got my first win at the Long Beach Grand Prix. So I can't complain.
As long as they don't introduce you and Mario and ask you to like bump into the wall on the entrance so he can get by and come in first. You know, we don't want to ham it up too much, but. It's going to be a cool weekend, I think, going to be a hot weekend. I still don't know what we're going to have here for a race, as you mentioned. And while we were talking, had a call come in from Jay Fry, so we need to call him back and get a little bit more info about what they're going to try and do with the old Tire Dragon to grip up that outer lane. So hopefully here in a few days, sweating our behinds off PT, we will know a little bit more about what's coming Saturday night in Phoenix. Brother, thank you so much for joining us here on the Week in IndyCar presented by Cooper Tires, and look forward to seeing you in a couple of days.
All right, I'll see you out here.